Rational discussion, common sense, open debate. RCR, Reality Check Radio with Paul Brennan.
Now, regarding our interview with Vanessa Beely, you can find plenty of coverage across RCR that provides the Israeli perspective. So why don't you head to our replays to search for that? Examples include Natasha Hausdorff, Ashley Church, Cam Slater's show, and Olivia Pearson's opinion column. And of course, any number of Perigo's perspective, both sides of the story, right here at Reality Check Radio. Vanessa Beely is an independent journalist, peace activist, and photographer. Vanessa was a finalist for one of the most prestigious journalism awards, the 2017 Martha Gellhorn Prize for Journalism, whose winners have included the likes of Robert Parry in 2017, Patrick Coburn, Robert Fisk, Nick Davies, and the Bureau for Investigative Journalism team. She writes at Substack and provides reports and commentary for British independent news outlet UK Column. She worked in an orphanage in Gaza, achieving entry into Gaza without papers by the tunnels. Vanessa was immersed in the realities of life in the Strip and the harsh realities of Israeli aggression and violence, which was unleashed shortly after her arrival. And Vanessa is returning to RCR, beaming in from Damascus, Syria, with an update for us on the Middle East conflict. Vanessa, welcome back to RCR. Nice to have you back again.
Oh, thanks for inviting me on.
Big picture question first, if you don't mind. As of this moment, we're talking. What is the state of things? Helicopter view up. What are you seeing?
Well, you know, since October the 7th, Israel has been increasingly provoking and expanding the war into the regional territories, which include Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Yemen, and of course, ultimately, Iran. And you now have a situation where Israel has carried out successive assassinations. I mean, we're not only talking about the actual assassination of the chief of the Hamas organization, but also the chief negotiator with Israel for the ceasefire options and the return of the hostages. And when I'm talking about hostages, I'm talking about the 120 so that remain in Gaza, and also the now, I think, around 10,000 that have been taken prisoner in the occupied territories of Palestinians. So, you know, we had this assassination in Tehran, during the inauguration of the new president in Iran. So extraordinary timing. This follows, of course, multiple other attacks, but including the attack on the Iranian consulate in Damascus back in April and the assassination of one of the most senior commanders in Hezbollah in southern Beirut, hours before the assassination of Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran. And that also obviously led to the killing of civilians, the damage to a civilian residential area. The drone actually missile landed or hit a building which was directly behind one of the biggest, the Barman Hospital, which is one of the biggest hospitals in the area. So little regard for civilian life or for civilian infrastructure from Israel. And of course, since then, there has been a lot of discussion of retaliation. America has been moving multiple, you know, personnel and military and naval hardware to the region. That's still ongoing. It's been the head of CENTCOM, Michael Perilla, has been twice to Israel to discuss the defense of Israel against any kind of, not only Iranian, but also Ansarullah, Yemeni, Iraqi, Lebanese retaliation for what's been going on. Because, of course, Israel also directly, for the first time, it's been attacking Yemen by proxy through the UAE and Saudi Arabia and various other terrorist proxies, including Al-Qaeda Arab Peninsula, just as it does in Syria. Of course, it supports ISIS and it supports Al-Qaeda and various other affiliates inside Syria. But also the US carried out an assassination or an attack on the PMU forces south of Baghdad, killing, I think it was four PMU members, which are the popular mobilization forces that are actually officially affiliated to the Iraqi military. So it's not, it is a state actor. It's not a non-state actor.
Mm.
And so, obviously, the retaliation is being discussed. People are saying, well, you know, are they actually going to do something because it's taking a very long time? But the reality is that if there is any kind of retaliation, it's a very delicate balancing act, because it's well known in the region that Israel does want to, Netanyahu does want to expand the war. Netanyahu wants a war with Iran. That's one of the reasons that he was in Washington very recently, and that is what he was discussing. That's why the U.S. is moving all of its military assets into the area and reoccupying Iraq and Syrian territory in the northeast. And therefore, you know, these countries have to prepare themselves not only for the retaliation, but also for what comes after, or potentially what comes before, because we know that Israel's MO is to preemptively strike under the pretext of self-defense. So that's also another potential action that Israel could take, which again will further escalate the conflict.
Yeah, Israel seems very confident in upping the ante. Is that because they know they've got the United States there?
Well, of course. I mean, you know, Israel has failed entirely after 10 months to defeat Hamas in Gaza, despite the horrific slaughter of men, women, and predominantly children. As we know, 50% of the victims have been children, as far as we know. We know from the Lancet, the foremost medical journal, that there are potentially up to 200,000 victims of the Israeli bombing. And in my opinion, that's going to be even higher because of the number of bodies that are unidentified and still under the rubble in Gaza. A horrific amount of civilian infrastructure has been destroyed. There were recent UN satellite images which show, I mean, pretty much all of Gaza now is destroyed and reduced to rubble. Or at least reduced to being unusable, like the water supply, electricity, fuel, etc. Right, and yes, of course, Israel is confident, because what's happened after the ICJ ruling, what's happened after the ICC arrest warrants, nothing.
Yeah.
In reality, what has Netanyahu done? He's increased not only the attacks on Gaza, but also the creation of settlements, the theft of land and property, the destruction of land and property in the occupied territories in the West Bank. And that's ongoing. You know, so this is an entire ethnic cleansing program, which, of course, began not really only in 1948, but even before that, from the Balfour Treaty onwards. So from 1917 onwards, but even before, I would say it's been about 100 years of intentional ethnic cleansing of Palestinians to make way for the Zionist colonialist settler project. And you know, that is his intention, and he's entirely supported by the United States, by the UK, by the EU, and a various, you know, a number of other allies of that entire, really genocidal, complicit cartel. And so therefore, yes, of course, Israel feels complete impunity, whatever it does. I mean, if you look at the fact that it assassinated Haniyeh in Tehran, all of the EU countries and the US and various other sovereign nations, what are they doing? They're pressuring Iran not to retaliate. They're not pressuring Israel not to violate international law. It's extraordinary. Nobody has actually gone to Netanyahu and said, please, can you stop provoking war? They're all going to Tehran and saying, please, can you not retaliate, because that will escalate.
Yeah. But, you know, it's well reported that, okay, so the US is all got aircraft carrier groups and, you know, their military is nearly $1 trillion a year, but some, many say that they're not the fighting machine they used to be. The adversaries of Israel are also pretty well armed. They've got technology, right? So there's a real risk in playing this game for Israel, and it seems so risky.
It's high risk, and what people forget, because, you know, everyone is focused and with the kind of political theater that's going on in the United States between now Kamala Harris and Trump, for me, it makes absolutely no difference who comes into power as president in the U.S. They don't have the power. Who has the power? The deep state multiple structures that are basically running the policy, and particularly the foreign policy and the policy, regional policy, from my perspective. As you know, I live in Damascus in Syria. So basically, we're in a situation where everyone is talking about, I mean, one of Trump's campaign promises is that he will stop the war in Ukraine, and everyone is picking up on this because of the potential of nuclear war between basically Russia and NATO over Ukraine. But in reality, everyone is forgetting that Israel has a nuclear program, and it's had one for decades. And that nuclear program is entirely secret. It's never been inspected. Who was the last person, President Kennedy, that wanted it inspected? And we know what happened to him, right? So everyone is conveniently forgetting that Israel has nuclear capability, and potentially Iran has nuclear capability. So we're in no less of a dangerous situation between Israel and Iran than we are between Russia and NATO. But actually, between Russia and NATO, with Russia and Iran, you have very cool heads. But Israel isn't. We've seen the psychopathy of the Zionist entity over the last 10 months. We should have seen it before, but this has been incredibly intense. Therefore, nobody can turn a blind eye to what's happened. I mean, only 2 days ago, on August the 10th, dropping three 2,000-pound bombs on a mosque while people were praying, and then claiming that there were Hamas combatants there. There were none. And that's been proven by people whose relatives were actually murdered in the attack. You know, so for me, the biggest danger here is Israel. It's not Iran. It's not Russia. It's not China.
Yeah, here's a question that weighs on a lot of minds, is that where we are located, you know, in our society and many Western countries, there's an automatic support for Israel amongst the you know, the populations. How do you explain that? Is that years of persuasion, the way it's reported, or because Israel's a democracy that, you know, it must be the one in the right? You've got any thoughts on
that? Yeah, I know. Well, I mean, I don't know how you can describe Israel as a democracy when a huge percentage of the population is living under apartheid. You know, that's a complete misnomer. You know, was South Africa deemed a democracy?
But it's cited. That's, you know, cited a lot.
Yes, of course. Of course it is. And the army is described as the most moral army in the world, despite the fact that they've now been exposed as carrying out the most appalling crimes against Palestinian prisoners that are not even proven to be combatants, right? I mean, this is, they're being fully exposed for their sadism and their absolute savagery against Palestinian civilians, which was ongoing before October the 7th, but it just wasn't being recorded 24/7 and kind of live streamed to Western audiences as it has been since October the 7th. But, you know, this is nothing new, this savagery, this rape, abuse, torture, using children as human shields. You know, this was started by the British, by the way. when Palestine was under British mandate, when the Palestinians started to realize that the Zionists were taking over their territory and taking over their homes, they rose up against the British mandate and against the Zionist settlement. And the British started using Palestinians as human shields to enable them to drive into resistance areas. So this began with the British and was then continued, of course, by the kind of Zionist love child of the British imperialist, which was then adopted by the US post 1947-48. So, you know, I think what has happened is since 1948, the Zionist movement has effectively infiltrated almost every sector of society in the UK, in the US, even in the EU. And they influence every single sector, which of course includes the political sector. I mean, people know that the majority of presidential candidates, for example, in the US, or even congressmen, are funded by AIPAC. It's the same in the UK. More than 70% of the Labour Party are friends of Israel, which effectively means they're lobbied by the Zionist movement through various organizations. Conservative Friends of Israel is even higher. I think that's up in the sort of the 80%. But they've infiltrated the tech sector, the social media sector, their entire unit, 8200, which is the IDF spy unit, basically, espionage unit. When they leave the unit, they establish usually tech surveillance startup operations, and those are now well and truly infiltrated into the US, the UK, and the EU. I mean, you know, Pegasus spyware, Oracle, which is storing all information from the British Ministry of Defence, Health Ministry, Education Ministry. So that means all of our private information is under the control, effectively, of an Israeli spy unit operation. Extraordinary.
No, I mean, when you're so confident.
But this is the point. If you look at the riots now in the UK, who's behind the far
just thinking that.
Right?
I was just thinking
that. Is the Zionist movement. The Zionist movement created Islamophobia, by the way. They took over organizations like Antifa, some of the so-called anti-fascist movements, and they started to introduce the Islamist extremists, the Islamophobic labels and titles pre-2000, so pre-9/11. You know, the Zionist movement, I don't think people realize, and even to some extent I didn't realize until I've been recently looking into it and speaking to Professor David Miller in the UK, who's been doing tremendous work on the Zionist movement infiltration of all sectors of society in the UK, but as I said, also in the US and EU. It's terrifying what they are controlling in our countries. And of course, you know, what is this? It's backlash against the anti-genocide protests. I'm not even going to call them pro-Palestinian protests because many people may not necessarily be educated on the Palestinian issue, but people are against genocide. I mean, it's not difficult to figure this out, right? So what happens is now the UK is being thrown into destabilization, potentially the US also. We're seeing similar patterns emerging there.
Wow. Okay. What about inside Israel? Is there tension amongst the Israeli population that we're not hearing about? That's not that obvious?
Of course, yes. Yes, of course. Okay. We are to some degree hearing about it, but Israel is imploding. I mean, you have a situation where if I kind of go around the clock, you have in the north the ongoing and increasing hostilities between Hezbollah and allies, because it's not only Hezbollah. And I also want to make a very quick point that Hezbollah is not a separate militia waging this war. Hezbollah is part of, if not a majority part of, the Lebanese government. It has political influence inside Lebanon and connections within the Lebanese government. And Hezbollah is not alone. There are various other parties also in Lebanon that are opposing the Zionist occupation, not only of Palestine, but also of Syrian and Lebanese territories. We shouldn't forget that. And so with the increase in hostilities, of course, I think it's around 200,000 settlers have been evacuated from the north and have been unable to return. So they are obviously now opposed to the government and perceive that they are being abandoned by the government. The families of the hostages, that, you know, it's becoming increasingly clear that Netanyahu is not remotely interested in bringing the hostages back safely. There are now, we've seen with the accusations of rape at Sadi Tayman, particularly the one military prison where the rape was carried out against Palestinian prisoners. And again, this is not an isolated incident. I've written about this extensively. Mm. And the prisons were stormed by the far right, which of course are represented by Ben-Gavir and Bezalel Smotrich, the finance minister. From Judea, that are basically becoming really a vigilante organization, very similar to the Irgun, the Israeli terrorist group back in 1948, that sort of got absorbed into the so-called IDF, eventually Haganah. They stormed the prisons, not in protest against the rape, but in protest against soldiers being prosecuted for rape. I mean, this is quite extraordinary, you know. So they're defending the right of Palestinians, basically. But that brings them to some degree potentially into conflict with the state of Israel. So you have a divide between the far right and the Knesset, right? So that's ongoing. You then have the potential for, I mean, there is a lot of confusion in Israel because basically the government is not handling the potential retaliation from Iran. There have been multiple articles detailing what could go wrong, basically. In other words, that they'll be without electricity, they will be without fuel, their major commerce centers will be shut down, as, of course, the port of Eilat has effectively been shut down by the Ansarullah operations, preventing or imposing a blockade on shipping through the Red Sea, and also targeting with drones. The Iraqi resistance and the Yemeni resistance have been targeting Eilat with drones. So Eilat is effectively bankrupt, according to Israeli reports, not even external reports. And so they are facing an internal explosion. They're being very quiet about the number of settlers that are actually leaving Israel. Okay. And we've seen Ben Gurion Airport absolutely sort of empty since basically the assassination in Tehran, because they're expecting the retaliation. You know, we've had flights stopped across the region. I'm sure you're aware of that in case of retaliation from Iran. And, you know, people may be saying, well, you know, Iran won't retaliate, etc. But you've got to understand the psychological war that's going on here. If you look at Israeli media, it's constantly theorizing about what Iran is going to do. It's in panic mode.
Okay.
Right. I mean, look at the amount, as you said, of military assets, naval assets that the US has moved into the region. I think it's the biggest mobilization on behalf of another country ever, which is insane.
Yeah, but the jury's out on whether that's appropriate fighting equipment for wars anymore anyway, or are they sitting ducks is the other thing.
Well, yes, you know, because, I mean, Iran now has Iran has the capability, even Yemen has the capability, as it's shown, of sinking any of these ships. So, yeah, you know, is Iran setting a trap? That's another perspective to look at. Is it setting a trap and giving more time for the U.S. to send more of its aircraft carriers and troop carriers into the region? Potentially, yes.
Well, you can make that argument. Is there an eschatological influence here? Is the current Israeli leadership driven by some kind of radical apocalyptic ideology? You know, the last war, you know?
Yes. Yeah. Very much so. Yeah, very much so. I think that's as crazy as it all sounds. That's very much the basis, for example, for the Christian Zionist factions. And of course, the Christian Zionist factions did make up a huge number of President Trump's former administration, and they make up a huge number of his following in the United States. So when people are saying, well, you know, Trump will be better than Biden, I would vehemently disagree. Yeah. Why? Because what did Trump do? Okay, he didn't start any wars. Did he end any wars? No. Did he pave the way for an increase in aggression in the region? Yes, because he brought in, for example, the Abraham Accords, which is effectively the creation or the launch of Greater Israel, the normalization with Saudi Arabia, which is, you know, it's on the cards. Saudi Arabia is being careful because its population is against what Israel is doing in Palestine. But UAE, Bahrain, Jordan, Egypt, all of them are, and if you look at the map of Greater Israel, well, that's what it is. You know, and he was going to put the embassy in Jerusalem. He basically said that, the Golan Heights should be Israeli. I mean, yeah, he didn't start any wars. But as I keep saying, did he end any? Did he actually, what did he do to further Zionist hegemony in the region? A lot. He did a lot. And in preparation, you know, because I tend to see all of these elections as organized. The selected candidate is who gets elected eventually. It's all orchestrated.
Mm.
So he had, if you like, his term. And if you remember back then, Americans were saying, oh, my God, we'll vote for Biden because Trump is so bad. And we're hearing exactly the same thing now. My God, we'll vote for Trump because Biden is so bad, or Kamala Harris is so bad. You know, and even in Syria, what did he do? He brought in some of the most savage economic measures under the Caesar sanctions, which are effectively starving the Syrian people. He continued to occupy the oil, Syrian oil, in the northeast. He burned agricultural crops by dropping thermal balloons. The military occupation dropped thermal balloons on vast swathes of Syrian territory to burn agricultural resources.
That's like the Agent Orange of the Vietnam War. Really.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, so yeah, guys, he didn't start any wars, but, you know, he prepared the way for war with Iran, basically. And that's what all of this has been doing. If you actually look at the pathway, right, from Obama onwards, that's what's been happening.
Yeah. To finish up then, and I guess we're talking about the resistance axes, aren't we, really, when we're talking about those other countries?
Yes.
Do you think, how do I ask this? What are the chances, not one out of 10, we won't go there, but what are the chances of a regional, you know, a full-blown regional, or even some kind of, because the tentacles that you mentioned go everywhere.
Mm.
They probably even go where we are.
Yeah.
A full-blown regional or even global conflict. Is it on the cards, do you think? Because I think we need to know.
I think I think it's inevitable, because I think it's inescapable, because you don't have rational players on one side. You know, you have very rational players on the within the resistance axis. People may kind of listen to me and say, well, are you crazy? You know, these are a bunch of terrorists. Well, no, they're not. You know, what the resistance axis has been trying to do is to basically contain and restrict that escalation. But what has Israel been doing? It's been consistently escalating and expanding and provoking. I mean, it's been provoking Syria for more than a decade by unlawfully bombing Syria on a very regular basis. The last one was only a couple of days ago in central Syria, right? And so at some point, I mean, now Iran is in a position, Yemen is in a position, Iraq is in a position, Syria is part of the axis. Many of the Iraqi attacks, by the way, are launched from Syrian territory, not from Iraqi territory. So Syria, despite waging its own war on multiple fronts, that's still ongoing, its territory is open to the resistance factions to carry out attacks against Israel and against the occupied territories, for example, the Golan Heights or the Golan territories, I should say. And Lebanon, Hezbollah. And all of these factions have an unalienable right under international law to respond against the Israeli attacks and against the Israeli aggression. But the problem is they are, I'm pretty sure, trying to calibrate those attacks to try and contain the escalation that will come from the Israeli side as afterwards, or as I said, even a preemptive aggression. That has not worked so far because Israel wants this war with Iran. That's clear. That's very clear. And so I think there will come a point where the resistance can no longer contain that expansion, where it has to respond, where Israel will push it into a corner where it can do nothing other than to respond. And that's where you have that incredibly dangerous point of escalation. And for me, I could be wrong because Iran is a very strategic player. We saw that after the assassination of Qasem Soleimani under the Trump administration. That's another thing, of course, that Trump did do. It played very cool, as Russia did, of course, when Turkey brought down the Russian jet in, when was that, 2016. You know, you have very different players on the non-aligned axis side, much cooler heads, much more aware of trying to evade a global war rather than provoke one. But if it's on the books to go to war with Iran in the US deep state, the UK deep state, then I think it's inevitable. And unfortunately, I do think it's on the books. It's been described as such. If we go back to Wesley Clark talking about the seven countries, I think it was seven, that would be targeted, Iran last. And of course, the idea of destroying Syria is to destroy the central hub of the resistance axis. Had Syria been broken by the regime change war that began in 2011, the resistance axis would not be as strong as it is today. And of course, for that reason, it was supported by Iran and Hezbollah against the terrorist proxy invasion orchestrated by the US and the UK-led alliance.
Wow. Gee.
Sorry, that was a long... No. I just come back to the eschatological reasoning?
The last war.
You know,
yeah.
Basically what this crazy belief is that the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which was why, of course, the operations by the resistance factions that began on October the 7th were called the Al-Aqsa Flood, in opposition to the destruction of the Al-Aqsa Mosque to create the Temple of the Mounts, which would then herald Armageddon, the apocalypse, and the apocalypse will bring in the second coming of Christ. That's. I mean, I'm not a theologian. I'm not an expert in this. But if you just read some of the literature that's coming out of the movements inside Israel to basically escalate this kind of global picture of apocalypse and Armageddon. And if you look at, as I said, Trump's administration, Mike Pompeo is a believer in all of this. That's where the Abraham Accords came in, to create the pathway for this. So yes, there is a very real threat from this ideology. because it permeates the Knesset, it permeates the Zionist government. Sorry, I just wanted to add that.
I think that's been on people's minds as well. So thank you for including that. Be careful what you wish for is what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
That was really, really interesting, Vanessa. Thank you for giving up your time all the way from Damascus, Syria, to kind of, update us, but also sort of give us that sort of holistic view that we don't get, you know, in regular media. That's for sure here.
No, it's very difficult to kind of tease out what's actually really going on from the misinformation that is put out there, and also very pro-Israel media coverage of what's going on. A lot of things are obfuscated, as they were, of course, in almost every single orchestrated war for decades now.
Thank you again, Vanessa Beely, for joining us, and I hope we can chat again. I won't say sometime soon, because that would probably mean something really dramatic's happened. But again,
well, you never know. I'm happy to come on if it does.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. Take care. Look after yourself.
Rational discussion, common sense, open debate. RCR, Reality Check Radio with Paul Brennan.
Now, regarding our interview with Vanessa Beely, you can find plenty of coverage across RCR that provides the Israeli perspective. So why don't you head to our replays to search for that? Examples include Natasha Hausdorff, Ashley Church, Cam Slater's show, and Olivia Pearson's opinion column. And of course, any number of Perigo's perspective, both sides of the story, right here at Reality Check Radio.
Right now, free speech is under heavy attack in New Zealand and overseas, with governments constantly devising new ways to enforce censorship. To make sure you never miss the critical news and breaking stories you rely on, join the RCR mailing list today. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.